EMP. And with the lack of anything electronic working at all, we have to prepare for the worst. We have printed records of the inmates and over 4,000 of these records to go through, Bender said. We need to start now and organize the prisoners into groups that can be processed if we have to start releasing them. It'll take several days to figure out who we can release and who we need to keep. We have to start now if we are going to be in any shape to make an informed decision. We have 48 hours to move the nonviolent prisoners out and deal with the rest. Why 48 hours? Braddock asked. While you were giving your little pep talk, Bender said, we got word from the kitchen that we only have enough food for a week. If this thing goes on, we have to save as much of the food as we can for the guards and the worst of the prisoners that must stay incarcerated. I get it. If we can release the drug offenders and other nonviolent prisoners, Hernandez continued, we can stretch our supplies for a lot longer. This is impossible, Braddock shot back.
Where's the state government?
Why hasn't the sheriff done anything? What the hell is taking so long to fix things? Captain, Judge Bender said, with a slow shake of the head, it may never get fixed. Chapter 12. Day 2. Charlie, Kirkman Specialty Clinic. The following day wasn't much different at the office. We turned off all the lights and unplugged any electronic device that might still potentially be drawing power. We also consolidated all our important perishables into our medical refrigerator. By law, all medications or chemicals that need to be kept cold had to have their own refrigerator apart from a general-purpose one. We kept the under-the-bar-sized unit going in the sterilization area. We pulled out and discarded the few unneeded medicines that were in there and put in the food items we needed to preserve. With most of the cardiac dyes we used kept at room temperature, we lost little of value. We shut down the refrigerator in the break room and even turned off the water heater. With outside temperatures expected to stay in the high 80s for another day or two, the water was plenty warm enough. Later in the evening, though, we started to get an understanding of what Dr. Kramer was worried about. Down the street at the Publix, a large group of people had gathered, demanding to be let in. The grocery store was about a block or two away, and on the other side of the street from the cardiology office. Janice and I decided to investigate what all the commotion was about, sneaking out the staff entrance. After a block, we got a good look at the store. It wasn't a pretty sight. From the look of things, we could see Mr. Wainwright at the entrance. The few remaining employees had set up a table which blocked the front door. It looked like he was trying to organize the mob into a line. I moved closer to hear what he had to say.
People, he screamed. We have enough for everyone. Please, just form a line to your left.
From what I could hear and see, the mob of several hundred was pressing up against the table and glass entrance windows. With the power out for more than a day, tempers were flaring, although most were listening to instructions. The savvy manager was distributing all the perishable items, including the frozen foods, meats, and fresh fish. He was saving the canned and packaged items for later, hoping against hope that the power would return.
Hey! A rough-looking man yelled. We need more than this!
Yeah!
Someone else yelled. How am I supposed to heat up a TV dinner? Nothing works!
Several customers at the front became agitated as the rear of the crowd pushed forward, worried they wouldn't be able to get their fair share.
Please, people, the manager shouted. If you don't get in line, you won't get anything. There's plenty for everyone.
Some of the men in the crowd began to organize the group, and eventually some semblance of order was found, and a line formed. As he began to distribute the food, problems began almost immediately. The first in line was a middle-aged woman dressed in a business suit and high heels. Her hair and makeup were a disaster. Without power for a hairdryer or lighting for a mirror, the facade of civilization was rapidly disappearing.
"Please," she uttered, "I need more than a couple of frozen dinners. I need personal supplies and cigarettes. I'm sorry, but this is all we can spare right now."
Others in the crowd heard her pleas, yelling at her to move along. Eventually, she relented, and the second person in line moved up. When the man only received two items, he complained bitterly that he had a family at home. Mr. Wainwright relented and gave the man four items. Mollified, he left and walked down the road towards Janice and me. As he passed, he turned to the two of us and muttered under his breath,
"It's shit over there," he said.
"What?" I asked. The disheveled man stopped and looked at me with eyes that didn't look too sane.
"I said it's shit down there. If you want anything, you better go now. This isn't going to last. That mob isn't going to listen to anyone for much longer."
With that, he turned and marched down the road towards a residential area about a mile away. I turned to Janice, and we gave each other a knowing look. Dr. Kramer was right. Things were going to get out of hand real soon. We continued to watch as the crowd slowly moved along. Mr. Wainwright began giving each person in line four items, and things were proceeding remarkably well when a scuffle broke out as a woman passed through and received her share. Another woman in the crowd saw her and screamed that her husband had already been through once.
"She's cheating!" the shrill woman yelled. "I know her! Her husband went through the line already!"
The accuser pointed to a man standing to the side. From his reaction, it appeared that the accusation was true. The shrill woman jumped out of line and knocked the other woman down. She began to gather up the dropped groceries when the husband jumped into the fray. Within seconds, a dozen men jumped the husband and began to beat him mercilessly. He did his best to cover his face as blow after blow and kick after kick rained down. His food was stolen, and the couple was left on the ground with nothing but pain and injuries for their troubles. The wife struggled over to her husband. He didn't move.
"My God," I said to Janice, "how can it get this bad this quick?"
Janice stood in shock. She started to go to the couple's aid when the husband slowly got himself to his feet and staggered to the back of the line once again. The wife sat on the ground sobbing. No one gave them comfort. I grabbed Janice's arm and kept her from getting involved.
"This is just the first day," I whispered. "We need to get back and talk to Dr. Kramer."
She nodded silently, and we retraced our steps back to the office.
I was afraid. If this was what civilization was becoming, and there was food still on the shelf, I wasn't looking forward to what the rest of the week would bring.
We silently entered the side door and found Dr. Kramer in his office.
"Dr. Kramer," I said, "Janice and I went down to the Publix."
"Is it still there?" he replied. At first, I thought he was joking, but then I looked into his eyes and saw he was dead serious.
"Yeah," I stammered.
"Well, I guess it has only been a day," he mused.
"I can't believe what we saw," Janice added. "People were like animals."
"Was anyone killed?" he asked back.
"Well, no," I replied.
"I'm surprised," he countered. "It won't be long now." He smiled and got up, leaving the room to check on his patients. Janice and I sat in stunned silence. He was actually amazed that no one had been killed. We didn't move for a while, and eventually Dr. Kramer returned from his rounds and sat heavily into his leather-backed chair.
"What are we going to do?" I asked.
"Go to Deland," he simply replied.
"Not yet," I countered. "You still may need us."
He didn't respond. Instead, he folded his hands together and placed them on his lap. Closing his eyes, he began to breathe heavily and fell asleep. Like shutting off a light, he was alert and talking with us, and then he was out. Janice and I quietly left and found our spot behind the front desk. We quickly made up our bed for the night. We lay silently next to each other, neither of us speaking, but unable to sleep. After a while, I felt myself drifting off when I heard three pops from outside. At first, I thought someone had set off firecrackers, but the first three were followed by two deeper booms. Gunfire. I looked at Janice, both of us knowing that things had turned for the worse. I prayed that Mr. Wainwright was safe and grabbed Janice's left hand with mine. We held each other like that until I finally drifted off to sleep. For the first time in my life, I was afraid to wake up the next day. Chapter 13. Day 3. Charlie, Kirkman Specialty Clinic. I awoke the next morning tired and short of patience. Another restless night, and all we had to look forward to was more of the same. Janice struggled again as she tried to pull herself together. She may not have been a morning person before the apocalypse, but sleeping on the floor at work, surrounded by the stifling air from 18 bodies, wasn't doing me any good either. The warm front had finally passed, and cooler air hit me as I opened the front door. Most everyone was awake, the morning light shining through the glass doors and the smell of coffee wafting down the hallway. It had to be 20 degrees cooler than the day before, but that was just a guess. The bite of the air actually improved my attitude. Another benefit of the cold air was the lack of need for the air conditioner. Dr. Kramer took me outside and showed me his generator backup system. He had an equipment room on the side of the building. It was part of the building with a double metal door that opened into a bank of batteries and several breaker boxes. Because one of their offices was furnished for minor surgery, a compressor and vacuum were necessary in here as well to run the equipment. With no need for the air conditioner, the generator had not kicked on in a while. Kramer checked the propane tank gauge and was pleased that there was still 70% left. His mood improved dramatically. "Wow," he said. "Well, that's encouraging. We started with 85% and have only used about 15% of the propane these past 4 days. "We're doing well?" I asked. I knew the answer, but his mood was so improved, I just wanted to hear a positive word or two from his mouth. We both needed it.
"I should say so," he gleamed. "We might be able to stay here for quite a bit longer. I think the electricity could last us upwards of 2 or 3 weeks.
We went back inside in a much better mental state. Breakfast was finished, and bellies were full. We went back into his office, and he invited me to sit with him. I suppose that I was different from everyone else there. I wasn't an employee, and I wasn't a patient. Our relationship was more equitable. Not that I had anywhere near the training he had, and several of the nurses had just as much college education as me, but we spoke as equals before the power outage, and now I was the closest thing to a colleague he had. After some lighthearted discussions about Florida football, we agreed that the end of the world couldn't have come at a better time, given their lackluster performance to date. It was then that I realized I knew very little about this man. "Dr. Kramer, I hope you don't take this wrong, but I was wondering about your family." He stopped smiling, and his demeanor softened. I wanted to probe further, hoping I didn't open up any wounds or painful memories. I realized that I have never seen any of his family pictures. Most private offices have the obligatory picture of the wife or wife and kids. His office was clinical and almost sterile in appearance. For all I knew, he could have been living in this room and sleeping on the couch since the day the clinic opened. "I expect that they are doing rather well," he finally said. They have a backup generator like we do here, and they are surrounded by enough land that I would expect that they will ride this out just fine. Well, that's good to hear, I replied. I just realized that I've never spoken with you about them. I guess it's because I've never seen any pictures here in your office. True, he replied. I don't keep any here. You know, I said, that's rather unusual. I've been in many offices, and I think you're the only one I know that doesn't have at least one picture of someone on the desk or wall. It's a conscious decision, Charlie, he replied. I like to separate my life into work and family. When I'm at work, I work. When I am at home, I put my attention into them. I don't like to mix the two. I suppose I can understand that, I said. But don't you find comfort in seeing someone's picture while you are here dealing with the stress of the job? No. It just reminds me that I have a better place where I could be. It's a distraction that might take my concentration away from my job and my patients. He pointed over my shoulder at a ceiling-to-wall bookshelf filled with medical periodicals. I have to read all those journals, he stated. They come every month, over a dozen scientific periodicals. It consumes me while I'm here. I don't want to miss reading an article that might just save someone's life because I was distracted by my wife's beautiful smile or my children's happy faces. I can't take that chance. I understood now. I understood that he was one of the few people I've met that allows for no wasted time. There was no downtime for Dr. Kramer, whether it was at work or at home. Before I could say more, he continued with the conversation. We bought some land out west of here, he said. My wife and I both love the country. I was raised on a small farm in West Virginia and decided to head south to leave the country behind. Truth be told, I hated the snow. But after college in Gainesville, I began to realize that I still loved the country life. My last residency in Cleveland cinched it for me. The snow and cold were brutal, and working in a larger city just didn't sit well with me. Well, you sure didn't pick a quiet spot here in Orlando, I countered. No, he smirked back. I didn't figure on all the growth. When I got here in 1985, the city was still manageable. More importantly, my lovely wife is from the area. And with kids and a desire to avoid the snow, we agreed on Orlando. But only if we could get out into the country and have a tract of land. So here you are, I chided him. Yes, he happily sighed. Here I am. How far away is your house?
Not far from Montverde, he replied.
About 20 miles away. There was a knock on the door as our friendly conversation was interrupted. Peg stuck her head in and informed us that several of the patients and staff wanted to have a meeting. We followed her out to the waiting room where all had assembled. One of the patients began the conversation. Dr. Kramer, he started, first I want to thank you for giving us shelter these past few days. But my wife and I feel that we need to start back home now that the weather has cooled off a bit. The man, in his late 60s, received several nods from like-minded people, including several of the staff. Well, certainly, he replied. But how far do you have to travel? Several patients began to speak at once. When it was all said and done, 6 of the 11 patients and the remaining staff members, except for Peg and Janice, had decided to return home. We need some food and water to make the trip, the patient continued. We were wondering if you could help us with that. Dr. Kramer had them all write down where they had to travel, and they determined how much food they would need. We collected several pillowcases from laundry and created sacks that they could use to transport their food and personal items. By noon, all that wanted to leave had left, most living within 10 miles of the facility. The drop in temperature would help them get home. More importantly, the rapid loss of civility meant that the longer they waited, the more dangerous it would become. After they departed, we took inventory of our remaining supplies. We needed more. That meant another trip to Publix. But with the sounds coming from down the street, it looked like Publix's official advertising motto, "Where shopping is a pleasure," might not bear out. Dr. Kramer stood on the front stoop of the building, looking down toward the grocery store, growing more concerned as groups of people were walking and trotting down the road towards what was sounding more and more like a riot in the making.
"We need to go now," Dr. Kramer said, "and I need to go with you."
Janice, Dr. Kramer, and I went back into the office and informed the remaining patients that we were going on a shopping trip. The remaining five patients were almost too old to walk to their cars, let alone strong enough to walk two long blocks. Dr. Kramer left Peg in charge, making sure they locked the doors. Before we left, he took Janice and me into the break room. He opened a drawer, and digging deep behind the plastic utensil tray, he pulled out two large steak knives, handing one to each of us.
"Take these," he said, as he handed one knife to each of us.
Each knife still had its cardboard protector covering the edge and tip.
"I can't use this," Janice stated.
"Take it," he stated again. "You may be glad you have it."
"Do you really think we'll need this?" I stated. "Just to go to the grocery store?"
"It's no longer a store," he replied. "It's a war zone." And with that, he spun on his heels and marched out the front. I heard Peg lock the door behind us, an unmistakable click that could be heard above the growing din coming from down the street. Janice looked at me and shivered. She buttoned up her lab coat all the way to the top. It wasn't nearly cold enough to need to do that, but I felt the same sense of vulnerability and buttoned my coat as well. Had it not been for Dr. Kramer's unwavering strides, I might never have been able to begin our journey. But seeing him walking with a purpose towards the gathering mob put some spine in me, and we quickly caught up with him. I placed my hand in my lab coat pocket and fondled the handle of the knife. As if he had some extra sensory perception, Dr. Kramer craned his neck towards us.
"Don't forget to take the sheath off the knife if you need it," he said.
Fortunately, our visit went without a hitch, but I just knew things were moving quickly in a bad direction. Chapter 14. Day 5. Charlie. Publix Grocery Store. Kirkman Road. A couple more days went by, and Dr. Kramer strode down the sidewalk and stopped short of the shopping plaza parking lot. Hundreds of people were clustered around the front entrance to the grocery store. The doors had been closed, and metal storm shutters covered the windows while a retractable metal gate was in place over the front door. People were pounding on the metal gate, demanding to be let in. We tentatively worked our way to the side of the building, standing next to the windows by the front entrance. The storm shutters covered all of the window except for the very outside edge. We were standing there, trying to decide what to do next, when I heard a tapping from the inside of the store. Someone was rapping their keys or some other metal object on the window from the inside. I pressed my face against the window and peered into the dark slit, where the shutter failed to cover the edge of the glass. Suddenly, a flashlight shone from within, illuminating someone's face in front of me. It was the boy that Janice had talked into letting us into the store. He backed up from the window a bit, and I could see him shining his flashlight on his hand. It was pointing back to the right, where we had gone the last time to get in the back door. I grabbed Janice, and she peered into the window as well, confirming the boy's intention to let us in the back once again. Janice told Dr. Kramer what had just happened, and we proceeded around back where we found the young man waiting. Janis roughed up his hair as we walked past him and into the darkened store.
"Hi, my name's Garrett," he said
as he closed the door. We could see a battery-powered lantern sitting in front of the store. Garrett led us to the lighted spot where Mr. Wainwright and two other employees were seated.
"Hello, Dan," Dr. Kramer said to the store manager.
"Dr. Kramer," he replied, "I wish I could give you a better welcome."
They shook hands warmly.
"How's your dad doing?" the doctor asked.
"Alive," the manager replied, "thanks to you."
"It was nothing," he responded to the compliment.
They both knew that was a lie.
"Doc," Mr. Wainwright said, "I hope you can tell me what the hell is going on."
"Let's go to your office so we can talk a bit," he replied.
Dr. Kramer turned to Janis and me and pointed to the aisles of food behind us.
"You two ladies," he commanded, "get your list and see if your friend can help you gather what we need."
Janis hooked her arm around Garrett's, and we stalked off to gather what we could.
"What's going on?" Garrett asked, after we left the other two. "Why is this happening?"
I glanced at Janis, and she gave me a nod. So I explained, the best I could, what Dr. Kramer had told me. After we had gathered about half of what we needed, I had finished telling him what was causing the power loss and what we had done the last 3 days.
"Wow," he sighed, "and I thought we had it bad."
"What about you?" I asked. "Where do you live?"
"I'm a student at Valencia State College," he replied. "Been working here while I take classes. My apartment is only about a mile from here, but my family lives near Ocala."
"Why here? I mean, why not another state college near you?"
"Computers," he replied.
He reached onto one of the shelves and shoveled a dozen cans of Spam into our cart.
"I want to get a computer degree from UCF, and I'm guaranteed entry if I finish my second year here at Valencia."
UCF had a premier computer department. Their ties with the military and computer simulation were known throughout the country, with multiple startup simulator companies springing up in the metro Orlando area. It was a very difficult department to get in, but Garrett had found a back door to the competitive program. Very smart. We finished our list and made our way back to the other two employees that had stayed with the store. We spent the next few minutes waiting for the doctor, learning that the others simply lived too far to make the walk. Both were over 60 years old and decided they couldn't make the journey. All were afraid of what was happening, and both were desperate to get home. Just then, Mr. Wainwright and Dr. Kramer returned from the manager's office.
"Garrett, Carla, and Ed," he started, "I want you to make up 4 carts with these items and take them to the loading dock."
He handed a list to the 3 employees. Their questioning looks prompted him to continue his instructions.
"If Dr. Kramer is correct, and I have never had cause to doubt him," he stated, "we're not going to have control of the situation for much longer. Apparently, an EMP has taken out all electronics."
Mr. Wainwright droned on to the 3 people, repeating Dr. Kramer's theory. Janis and I tuned it all out, having heard it all before and uncomfortable with the thought that he was correct.
Nothing like bad news repeated to shut a brain down.
When he was finished, Dr. Kramer excused us, and we left out the back once again.
"What are they going to do?" I asked.
"They're making up their own survival package. He's going to stash it all in one of the dumpsters out back when they need to abandon the store. I just hope they have time to clear out before it gets too violent."
Suddenly, Janis stopped.
"I'll be right back," she said. "Give me a minute."
She sprinted back to the lighted area where the Publix's employees were gathered. After a minute or so, she returned, and we left the building, pushing our cart down the long backside of the plaza, out the rear delivery entrance, and onto Kirkman Road,
about 200 yards from the grocery store's front door. Not an hour had passed since we first arrived, and the mob that was waiting to get fed was easily double the size. At least 500 people were pressed against the metal shutters. A steady hammering of fists was starting to come from the ones in front as they screamed, demanding to be let in. "Why did you go back into the store when we were leaving?" I asked Janice. "I told Garrett to come find us when it hits the fan," she said. At first, I thought she was playing games with the poor kid, but the look in her eyes told me otherwise. There was real concern in them, and as she looked past me to the growing crowd, I could tell it was only going to get worse. Chapter 15, Day 5 through 6, Charlie, Kirkman Specialty Clinic. Evening had come, and the sound of gunfire had begun in earnest. We kept the lights off for fear of giving away our location, and that there was power to the building. Dr. Kramer had created piles of food and medicine, one for each of the remaining patients, as well as one for himself. Janice and I were set with our backpacks that were nicely tucked in the closet. "Charlie," he said, "my office, please." I followed him back, the way lit by a small flashlight he produced from his pocket. We sat in the break room, and he grabbed a couple of Cokes from the refrigerator. We popped them, and each took a sip. "At some point," he said, "you two need to leave. It's dangerous and only going to get more so over the next week. And before you say anything," he continued, "realize that by next week, two women walking with supplies won't last a day out there. You'll be dead or worse when people get truly hungry." "Doc," I replied, "I can't. I can't leave you like this. It isn't fair." "Never said it was. But like triage, I have to pick who is worth fighting for and who is not. Those patients out there," he said, "they aren't going to make it. Even if I could get them home, they have no chance. Who's going to fend for them when their food runs out? The best I can hope for is that they can spend their last days with family or friends." "But you two," he continued, "you two do have a chance, and you need to take it now." Just then, we heard something that we hadn't heard in days, the sound of a truck, and by the deep growling of its engine and pitch of the noise, it sounded like something big. We both sprinted to the front door and out onto Kirkman Road. Looking down the 6-lane street, we could see a dump truck rumbling up from the interstate, knocking aside any stalled car that happened to get in the way. From the sound of the giant beast and the rough way the gears were being shifted, it seemed that the driver didn't have too much time behind its wheel. "I thought you said nothing was working," I said. "Does this mean it's over?" Dr. Kramer said nothing, but continued to stare at the truck as it turned into the grocery store parking lot and aimed itself directly at the front door. The horror of what was coming mesmerized me and kept me from turning away as it smashed through dozens of people that simply didn't move fast enough to get out of the way. Bodies were flattened, crushed, or dismembered as it plowed into the front of the store and blasted a hole in the building. The hundreds of the remaining uninjured people flooded through the breach, trampling the already fallen and smashing those that were too slow. Janice screamed and dropped to her knees as I finally turned away from a sight I knew would haunt me for many nights to come. I joined Janice, squatting next to her, holding her as she sobbed. The terror and uncertainty of the past few days finally bursting forth through her tears and wails. Just what had people become in a few short days? "Come on, girls," he said, "back in the building."
"We have to,"
Janice choked.
"We have to go and help."
No, Dr. Kramer gently replied. No, we don't. There's nothing you can do for any of them now. They are all too far gone. Only more death waits for you down there. He guided us back to the office, where we told the others what we had seen. I followed Dr. Kramer back to the break room and confronted him. He told me that vehicles wouldn't work, and I just witnessed a dump truck smash over a dozen people to death.
I thought you said nothing was working, I shouted.
Nothing with computers, he calmly replied. A lot of heavy equipment and older cars have a good chance of being in working order since they don't rely on computers to run. But just about any car less than 30 years old is out for the count. I briefly stared at his dark silhouette, then went back to the waiting room where Janice sat in a corner, a blanket wrapped around her as she scrunched up in one of the reception room chairs. Her sobbing had subsided, but she didn't respond when I sat down next to her. I couldn't see much in the dark, but I could tell she was almost in shock. Her breathing was quick and shallow, and I could feel her tremble as I gently checked her pulse. It was rapid, and her skin was a bit clammy. I got Dr. Kramer, who guided her back to the first surgical suite, and laid her down on the padded table. I got some additional blankets to make a pillow. I retrieved a chair from the reception area and sat next to her, holding her hand under the covers, whispering that everything was going to turn out just fine. After a while, I must have dozed off. I was jolted to my feet when more gunfire erupted outside. This time, however, it was close. I jumped up, my neck sore from leaning against the back of the chair, and quickly moved to the reception area. Dr. Kramer was already there, standing in the front door, staring down the street toward the Publix. I was shocked as I heard the sound of several cars racing about the parking lot down the street. Several old sedans were chasing down stragglers as they sprinted out of the grocery store. Suddenly, gunfire erupted from the back window of a large four-door Chevy, and two looters dropped to the ground, shot as they ran. A total of three old vehicles circled the pavement, like an old-style wagon train spinning about, only this circle spat death at anyone who exited the store. Whooping came from the attackers and cries from the victims as everyone in the store scattered to the wind, hoping to avoid the gunfire. We watched as the cars finally stopped in front of the Publix, and almost a dozen men dashed into the store, illuminated by the high-beam headlights from the cars. More gunfire exploded, and after a minute or two, things settled down. Suddenly, another flurry of gunshots bellowed forth from the store, and all went quiet. We peered down the road and watched as food and other items were brought out and piled into the car's massive trunks. A half an hour went by before two of the cars turned back and went south, away from our clinic. The third car remained, its lights beaming into the hole left by the dump truck earlier that day. After a few more minutes, we could see the three remaining men loading prescription bottles into the back seat of the car.
Druggies, Dr. Kramer said. We better get inside now.
We shut the glass front door, and he locked it.
Everyone, he said, get to the back of the building. I need you to clear the reception room.
We all made our way to the back, where all were deposited in the last of four surgical rooms. As Dr. Kramer and I went back to the reception area, he told me of his concerns that the looters would find this office and come looking for drugs. We moved enough waiting room chairs to the back to handle all the remaining patients. I made my way into the first surgery room to be with Janice as she shakily came out of her stupor. I filled her in on what was happening when we heard the sound of a car speed into our parking lot and abruptly stop, its headlights shining into the waiting room.
Quick, Dr. Kramer hissed. Find a place to hide, and for God's sake, get out your knife.
I reached into my pocket and felt the cardboard cover, slipping it off after removing the knife from my jacket. My hands trembled as I pressed against Janice. We cowered in the corner of the room, trying to hide behind a crash cart. It wouldn't do us much good if the druggies had a flashlight. Dr. Kramer shut the door as he left the room, and we both smashed our bodies together, two shivering girls getting ready to face people that had just run over, shot, or beat to death any number of folks, just to get a pill, just to stay high. Civilization was falling around us. I was not prepared. A minute passed when we heard the crash of broken glass. A moment later, the front door clicked open. The looters must have reached through the smashed door and twisted open the deadbolt. They were in. I could hear them as they excitedly talked, doors being kicked open as they marched down the hall. Tables were being overturned, and chairs and Lord knows what else were being thrown against the walls. More shattered glass when the break room, right next door, was feeling the brunt of the lunatics as they moved inexorably towards our room. Janice muffled a cry as the refrigerator was slammed to the ground in the next room. I held her with my left arm, my right arm holding the pitifully small knife. I had decided that I was not going to be taken without a fight. Damn them, I thought. I will die before I let them take me, or Janice, or the patients. I knew death was waiting, but at least I had a chance if I stuck. I wasn't going to let the bastards get me without a price. Anyway, that is what I told myself. I steeled myself for what I knew was coming next. The sounds from the break room had stopped, and I could see a beam of light shining under our surgical room door as the punk stepped in front of our hiding place. I let go of Janice and braced myself. I would lunge at the son of a bitch and stick him before he could get us. My legs were taut as I envisioned myself in the starting blocks of one of the hundreds of swim meets I had participated in. I was coiled and ready when the door exploded inward, a heavy kick from the scumbag sending it off its hinges and flying into the room. That I wasn't prepared for. The violence of his entrance and the door crashing back at me held me momentarily stunned. By the time I recovered, the brute was shining his flashlight directly at Janice and me, freezing us in place. The vision of a deer in the headlights suddenly became reality as my muscles refused to budge. There we were, squatting behind a mobile crash cart, me holding a pitiful knife and, no doubt, the druggie holding a gun. We were screwed. "Hey, Daryl," the punk screamed over his shoulder. "Look at what I found here." I couldn't see at all, the flashlight blinding me, keeping me from even attempting to fight back. I had no idea where he was other than somewhere behind the intense white beam. As I started to stand up, the druggie hissed back. "Drop that knife or I'll shoot you and your friend dead. Drop it now." I held on, trying to find a way to strike back. We were trapped and there was no way out. I lost all hope and dropped the knife to the tile floor where it bounced with a crisp ring against the ceramic tile. "Aw," he said. "Now that's a good girl. I ain't gonna kill ya. Just look at you two. Pretty as all get out. Nah, we ain't gonna kill something as pretty as you. We just came to get us some party pills. And here, we found us some party girls." The thug yelled back for his companions. "Hey, Daryl, in here. I done found some..." Suddenly, the flashlight toppled out of his hand and onto the floor at his feet. I heard a sudden gasp. The brute stumbled into the room and went down hard on the tile floor, the flashlight illuminating his upper body. A second person crashed on top of him, and Janice and I leapt back to the wall. When the flashlight had finally settled down, I saw Dr. Kramer straddling the man's back, an IV pole in the back of the thug's head and sticking out of his mouth on the other side.
Are you girls all right? He asked.
I was too stunned for words. I just saw Dr. Kramer jam a stainless steel rod through a man's head. He had just saved our lives.
Where is his gun? He quickly asked.
I don't know,
I stuttered.
Dr. Kramer grabbed the flashlight out of the rapidly pooling blood on the floor and began to search the surgical room's floor for the man's gun.
I don't see it, he cried. It has got to be here somewhere.
It only took a few seconds to search the small room. There was no gun. Just then, another flashlight shone at us from the doorway. A second hood had arrived, and the sound of a gun's hammer cocking back left no doubt about who had a firearm.
Damn you, he shouted, looking at his fallen friend. You son of a bitches! You killed him! Now get against the wall! Now!
The three of us raised our hands and backed up until we could move no more. Once again, the flashlight blinded us as the thug moved forward to his fallen companion.
Look at what you've done. I'm going to shoot all three of you, you bastards. I should make you suffer.
I waited for the first bullet to come. I closed my eyes. I didn't want to see it coming. For all my bravado earlier, I felt so hopeless and alone. I just wanted it to end. I wasn't ready to die, but I knew deep in my heart that it was my time. All I could do was think about my mom and dad and pray that I wasn't going to suffer. A loud thud broke the silence of the room, and the second man's flashlight fell to the floor. A second thump woke me from my death trance, and I could see the flashlight shining on the man where he was now laying on the floor next to his friend, blood dripping down the side of his face onto the floor. His body twitched once and became still. Quickly, someone grabbed the fallen man's light, and I heard a voice like an angel.
Hey, guys, the mystery man said. Are you all right?
Yeah,
I said shakily.
Then I quickly followed up.
Who are you?
Oh, sorry.
With that, our savior shone the light back on himself. He carried a tire jack and wore a Publix uniform.
It's me, Garrett, he said. Janice invited me to join the party. I hope that's okay. Garrett, thank God, Dr. Kramer shouted. There's at least one more out there.
Dr. Kramer shone the flashlight on the floor and found the second man's revolver lying next to his body. He scooped it and hustled out into the hallway, pointing the gun down toward the lobby and front door.
It's okay, Garrett said, stopping Dr. Kramer. There was one more. He's by the car. But he's dead, too.
I had two tire irons, he continued. The other one's out there. I crushed the guy's skull while he was smoking. Just couldn't bring myself to pull the crowbar back out of his head.
Garrett began to shake, his flashlight beam bouncing around the room as his body dumped the adrenaline that comes from a fight-or-flight situation. Dr. Kramer put his arm around the young man and gently took his flashlight.
Come on, son, the doctor whispered. You saved our lives. Let's find a chair while I go outside and clean up the mess.
The four of us returned to the waiting room where we sat Garrett down. Janice retrieved a Coke from the tumbled refrigerator and sat next to him, brushing his hair and holding his hand. Thank goodness she bonded with this guy. It saved us all. I had no doubt that the patients and the doctor would have been killed, and Janice and I would be in whatever hellhole those creeps inhabited. Rape would have been the best we could have hoped for. It was unimaginable. A few minutes later, the doctor had gathered the patients, and we all sat in the reception area. Dr. Kramer found the first man's pistol in the hallway by the room Janice and I had hidden in. There was a third gun in the car. Dr. Kramer turned the old vehicle off and returned to the office. We let Garrett calm down a bit, then heard about the horrors down at Publix. It seems that the dump truck had blasted its way through the front entrance, taking out the other two employees. Carla and Ed were crushed when they were preparing to open the doors and feed the crowd outside. Mr. Wainwright and Garrett were in the back, gathering more food, when the wall exploded in, and the truck crushed his poor co-workers. They quickly took refuge in the manager's office and locked the metal door, unable to prevent the looting. There was nothing they could do. The mob was too large and too desperate. Their need too great. After hours of watching the carnage through the upstairs glass window, the crowd began to settle down. Most had loaded up what they could and retreated back to where they came from. Mr. Wainwright decided it was time to abandon ship, and he and Garrett proceeded down to the main level. They needed to get out of there, go to their stash in the dumpster behind the building, and make their way out of the area. For Garrett, that meant finding Janice. For his manager, it meant a long walk to his home in Kissimmee. When they reached the main floor, the gunfire began. Looters were caught in the middle. Some ran out into the melee, while others fled to the back of the store, seeking cover from the fusillade of bullets. The two retreated once again and watched as almost a dozen thugs entered the store and looted what was left. A number of people were trapped as the back entrance had been locked shut. Mr. Wainwright still held the key. Trapped between the back of the store and the open front door, they begged and pleaded to be let go. The thugs began to shoot them one at a time. Mr. Wainwright couldn't take it anymore. He left Garrett in the upstairs manager's office, leaving his keychain with the young man, but removing the pharmacy cage key, and hurried down to try and bargain with the druggies. They were rattling the metal cage that had been locked down to the floor, trying to get to the narcotics in the back. Garrett watched as Mr. Wainwright flagged down the criminals. The gunfire abated while they talked. They made their way to the pharmacy, and the cage was unlocked, giving the hooligans everything they wanted. Mr. Wainwright turned to face the remaining trapped people and pointed them to the front opening. It seemed that he had negotiated their safe passage by opening the pharmacy gates. That is, until one of them pointed his pistol at the back of the kind manager's head and pulled the trigger. Before his body hit the floor, the remaining six people were shot as well, as almost a dozen guns opened fire on the unarmed group. It was over in seconds.
"I couldn't believe it," Garrett said. "He did everything he could to protect those people, but it didn't matter. He gave them everything they wanted, but they shot him like a dog."
"Lesson learned,"